Chapter 16. Paddington Old Cemetery. Missy Hudson gets back to Baker Street shortly before midday and stops on the pavement, examining the house that has been her home for so many years. It's as if she's seeing it for the first time. The plans that she found in the attic are in her bag, but she has examined them so many times that she doesn't need to take them out. The truth is right in front of her eyes. She's surprised she never saw it before. Between 221, her home, and 223, the empty property where Silas Welburn was murdered, a new house has been slotted in, like an extra volume in a crowded bookcase. The black railings must have been cut and bent round the new set of steps that lead up to the front door. According to the plans, the space to the left of this door should have been her parlour, but she has never had a parlour. Even the doorway, which she noticed in the old photograph, has been taken away. The building works cannot have taken place very long ago. The heavy rainfall of the last winter has caused some damage to the bottom of the doorframe of 221B. The paint has peeled away, exposing wood that looks brand new. She smiles to herself. It's a piece of deduction that would have impressed Sherlock Holmes. She lets herself into her home and is disappointed to find it empty. Her two lodgers are not there. She goes upstairs, drops her case in her bedroom, then spreads the plans in front of her. The bedroom is the wrong shape. The funny thing is that she always thought that it was somehow truncated, considering the height of the ceiling. It meant that the pendant light wasn't quite in the middle, which always bothered her when she was trying to drop off to sleep. As with other Victorian townhouses, each room should possess a fireplace, and she always thought that the one in the bedroom had simply been filled in. But now, comparing what she sees with the plans of what was built, she realises that the wall has somehow been moved a couple of feet to the left, and the fireplace must be behind it, on the other side. In other words, it is the occupants of 221B who now enjoy its warmth. She is quite sure she knows what has happened. It's one of Finn's tricks. He needed money, so he hived off part of the house to create a new dwelling, which he must have later sold to the religious community, the mendicants who moved in. Of course, he will have done it without planning permission, without any license, probably without very much building skill. Anything to avoid tax and save cash. She's surprised, though, that he never mentioned it to her. Finn was always one to boast about his exploits. And how does Silas Welburn fit into all this? Could the two men have been in business together? Again, it seems unlikely. Finn knew the other man, but they weren't close. For the first time, Missy wonders what she is going to do. The first question she asks herself is, could 221B legally belong to her? Her own house is more than big enough for her needs, and she doesn't want to get into a fight with her neighbours who may be completely unaware of the arrangement and who are, after all, a religious sect. But she has a sense that this isn't right. Her living space has been stolen from her. She goes down to the kitchen, makes herself some tea, and finishes off the last of the bacon. At the same time, she notices that the larder is too close to the oven. It has surely been moved forward too. And although three of the corners of the room are square, the fourth has been fashioned into a curve. It seems that she has been living in one of those fairground funhouses designed to entertain and beguile its visitors, and all along she has been blithely unaware of it. She wishes she could talk to Sherlock and John, perhaps get their advice. Then she is annoyed with herself. Why does she need them? She can deal with this herself. She marches out of the house and knocks on the door of 221B. There is a short silence. Then it is opened by a man with long grey hair, dressed in a simple robe. He has young eyes in an old face. He cannot disguise the fact that he is irritated to see her. "I'm Missy Hudson," she says. "I live next door." "I know who you are, but this isn't a good time. We've just begun our afternoon contemplation." "This really won't take a minute," Missy insists, "but I need to speak to you. It's about the house. I've noticed something very peculiar, and I'm just wondering if you have any knowledge of what's been going on."
"I'm sorry, I don't understand."
"I presume you bought the house from my late husband, Finn Hudson?"
"The house was purchased by our founder, who went by the name of Gabriel. I'm afraid I have no knowledge of the business arrangements that were involved."
"But it was brand new when you moved in. It didn't exist before."
The man frowns. "How do you know this?"
"I've seen the plans. I know it sounds crazy, but my husband,
stole half his own house and sold it to you. I don't want to cause you any trouble, but I just think it's something we need to sort out.
The man looks up and down the street.
You have two lodgers, he says.
Sherlock Holmes and John Watson.
Yes, but they're not at home.
The man smiles, suddenly more friendly.
My name is Dominic, he says.
I must apologize if I seemed a little
brusque just now. We take our afternoon contemplation very seriously.
Perhaps it would help if you examined the building from this side. Would you like to come in?
That's very kind of you, Dominic.
Missy Hudson steps over the threshold of 221B Baker Street. The door closes behind her. Shortly after 5 o'clock, a fog falls on London. It is, of course, unlikely and unseasonable, but then who these days expects anything of the weather? Wildfires in Scotland and the Lake District, a rise in ocean levels that has left Cambridge with sea views, heat waves in November and snow in May. There were always warnings, but nobody listened. Not even when Storm Greta tore down the west coast of England, removing 80% of the trees in Galloway Forest Park and flicking away the Isle of Man as if it had been a cork floating on the water. So, thick pea soup fog rolling into a major city is nothing to write home about, even if you are able to find the postbox. Sherlock Holmes and John Watson enter the cemetery from the southern side, the Lonsdale Road. The fence has been torn down here, and it allows them the element of surprise. John is drawing on his army experience. It is better to get a sighting of this James Ryder, the trusted friend of Irene Adler, before he sees them. East Lodge, one of the two Gothic-style chapels built on either side of the main gate, is a 15-minute walk away. The cemetery itself is built in the shape of a horseshoe and extends to some 24 acres. Nobody has been buried there for a very long time, but its most famous resident is Michael Bond, who, appropriately, created the character of Paddington Bear. In fact, the two of them see very little as they make their way forward. The fog has insinuated itself into the cemetery, as if this is the place it most likes to hang out, wrapping itself around the gravestones and obscuring the paths. The light is already fading, and this adds to the sense of desolation. There is no breeze, so the trees are still, and if there are any birds in the trees, they are silent. The only sound is the crunch of Holmes's shoes on the gravel. John has chosen to walk on the grass, and after a few steps, he reaches out and stops his companion.
You're making too much noise. They'll know we're coming, he half whispers.
Oh, they already know we're here, Holmes replies cheerfully. John stares.
How can you be so sure?
We're walking into a trap. He sounds so unconcerned that for a moment John assumes he must be joking. But then he remembers that Holmes never makes jokes, and, not for the first time, he's astounded.
You know we're walking into a trap.
Oh, yes.
And James Ryder?
I doubt that he exists. John stops.
Wait a minute, he exclaims. Could you explain this for me? First of all, how do you know?
Holmes is impatient to continue, but stops and faces him. Nothing that Irene Adler said or did made any sense at all. First of all, having made it clear that the Bohemia observed the strictest rules of omerta, or complete silence, she contradicted herself by supposedly telling me what I wanted to know. But why do it this way? She could have simply given me an address. She could have said that I'd find the Red Circle having coffee and croissants at the Café Royal on Regent Street. She didn't do that. Instead, she suggested I meet with someone completely spurious, someone by the name of James Ryder, and that he would be waiting for me somewhere far away from Regent Street or anywhere else where there might be witnesses, namely the cemetery. Obviously, she's scared for her own safety. She has no choice but to lead us into an ambush. I suspect that someone, several people actually, are going to spring out at us any minute and do us both harm. I take it you have your revolver?
Of course. Go on.
I watched her text, Mr. Ryder, although, as I said at the time, I'm quite surprised that she had any signal in a subterranean club. But whether she did or not, she simply didn't tap enough keys to send a message of the complexity needed to explain who I was, what we wanted, and why. The same is true of the reply. It came too quickly, as if the sender had already typed the next text message and was holding his phone with his thumb above the send button.
That all seems eminently reasonable, Holmes, John says, but may I just ask one more question?
Go ahead.
What the hell are we doing here?
He almost shouts the words,
Why would you want to walk into a trap?
For information. If someone thinks we are worth kidnapping or assaulting, then they must know something we don't, and even meeting them and seeing their faces might provide us with the information we need to resolve the mystery we're investigating.
And how would that information help if we're both killed?
But Holmes doesn't answer that one. You said you had one more question, and that's your third, he remarks. He continues walking. Watson hesitates. Then with a muttered curse, he takes out his revolver and follows. The fog is a ghostly sea floating just above the ground. They push their way through, with graves half concealed on either side, the path leading them from one end of the cemetery to the other. A couple of lamps are glowing on the way, but the light comes nowhere near the ground. They illuminate only the fog, turning the white yellow. Ahead of them, East Lodge pokes up like something out of a fairy tale. It is the same color as the fog, a fantastical construction surrounded by ornate shrubs with tiny, church-like windows looking out over the cemetery. This is supposedly where James Ryder will meet them, but as they approach, John is looking in every direction, waiting for the trap he now knows is about to be sprung. A movement behind a gravestone. Was it real or imagined? The sound of a footstep on the gravel behind them. He twists round, but there is nobody there. They reach a wide, circular space with the old iron gates of the cemetery in front of them. The gates are ajar, and John is already calculating how long it will take to run between them to reach the main road on the other side. He hears a horse and cart go by, but he cannot see it in the fog, and it occurs to him that this might be what it's like to be dead, to be stuck in one world, aware of the other, but eternally separated from it. The door of the East Lodge opens, and a man steps out in front of them. Bald, with very white skin and very black eyes, wearing a black coat with an astrakhan collar. He stands in front of them. Holmes stops dead in his tracks. Watson knows at once that something is terribly wrong. Even when he was at his weakest, when he had been lying half-drowned on the Thames path the night the two of them met, Holmes had never shown any sign of weakness. But that has changed. Right now he is looking terrified. The man who has come out of the East Lodge sees it too. He is amused. Holmes, Watson mutters, then more loudly. Holmes! Holmes says nothing. He does not seem able to move. I am naked. I am in a cell stretched out on the floor, which is made of white tiles. I can hear the constant hum of machinery. It is all around me, but also inside my head. I feel I am part of it. There is a pool of blood around me, my blood. It is a brilliant shade of red. I try to lift my head, but my neck is too weak. I have been tortured. A tunnel of pain that has stretched through the days and into the weeks. I do not know how long I have been here. I do not know if I will ever be allowed to leave. A man speaks to me, a voice I know. We own you, he says. You must understand that. You cannot fight against us. I try to answer. My mouth is too dry. Would you like some water? You haven't eaten for days. He tries to sound kind, concerned. I know he is neither. This is so unnecessary, he continues. We should be working together. There is so much we can learn from one another. You just have to accept what you are. Slowly. Painfully, I lift my head and look at the man who is sitting on the metal stool in front of me. I see the watch chain stretching across his stomach. I spit at him. Bright red globules spray out across the tiles, staining his polished shoes. No, 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 he says, sadly. He reaches down with the long metal rod that he always carries. It touches my flesh. I hear the crackle of electricity and smell my own burning flesh as... Are you Mr. James Ryder? Watson asks. No. Holmes's voice cracks. He can barely squeeze the words out. His name is Jonathan Blaw. You know him? Watson has never felt more out of his depth. Holmes has become a frightened child, utterly helpless. Holmes, speak to me. Holmes, is that what you call yourself? Blaw is amused. He is even uglier when he smiles. That's his name, Watson exclaims. He has no name,
Blore takes a step forward. I have to say, I'm quite pleasantly surprised. He continues, despite everything, you haven't forgotten who you belong to. He spreads his hands. You know, I've been looking for you all over London. It's my job to bring you back.
What are you talking about?
John cuts in. He steadies his revolver, pointing it at this grotesque, bald man, a vulture in a suit.
What do you mean, bring him back? Bring him back where? And what happened to James Ryder?
Blore simply ignores him. He has no interest in the gun, even though it's aimed at him.
Where have you been hiding, Mr. Holmes? He asks. Have you seen Moriarty? Moriarty?
Holmes looks puzzled, half remembering something or someone that he encountered long ago.
He's the one we really want. In the great scheme of things, he's much, much more important to us than you.
A thought seems to occur to him.
In fact, if you were to lead us to him, we might even let you go. You could live your own life, what's left of it, in peace. We could come to an arrangement.
It is a shadow, a breath, a rustle of cloth that gives them away. While Blore has kept them occupied, six men, wraiths, mercenaries, have crept up behind them. When John turns, he sees himself surrounded by creatures who would quite honestly be less threatening if they had indeed risen from the graves. They are all armed with semi-automatic pistols that make his own service revolver look as antiquated as it is. Dressed in a vaguely paramilitary uniform of black puffer jackets and combat trousers, they are all young and have that pale, mean-spirited look of ex-convicts. They blame the world for what has happened to them. They are here to take revenge.
And now I think it's time for you to put down your weapon, Blore suggests, speaking to Watson for the first time, his voice thick with contempt. You are irrelevant to this situation and clearly have no idea of the stakes that are involved. At the moment there is a very, very small chance that you may be able to leave here alive. I'd advise you to seize it.
He turns to Holmes and modulates his voice, trying to sound less vindictive.
I'm not going to hurt you, he assures him. I just want to get you back to where you belong.
And where is that?
John demands, refusing to remain silent.
It's strange. He suddenly sees Sherlock Holmes being taken from him, and it hurts.
Blore shakes his head. He says nothing. John points his revolver directly at Blore's heart. If the six men close in, if one of them fires, he will at least take out the ringmaster before he goes down himself.
Don't move, he warns. I wasn't planning to, Blore replies.
It's a great pity. I gave you a chance to save yourself and you've thrown it away. Your weapon is antiquated. You're outnumbered.
He half smiles.
How fitting that you should meet your end in a cemetery. At least you won't have far to travel.
Then Holmes speaks, not to Blore, but to John.
Give me your gun, he says quietly.
What? Trust me, do as I say.
Later on, John will say that this is the moment that crystallized his relationship with Sherlock Holmes. It is the worst thing he can do. It gives away the one advantage that the two of them seem to have, but there is something in Sherlock's voice that persuades him. He doesn't hesitate. He gives his friend the gun. Sherlock Holmes presses it against his own temple.
I'm not coming back with you, he says almost gently, measuring out each word. I would rather die. If any of your people take a single step towards me, I will pull the trigger.
He glances at Blore.
I'm aiming at you too, Mr. Blore.
With a bit of luck, the bullet will pass through my brain and hit you between the eyes. It would be both satisfying and economical to take out both of us with one shot.
You're mad!
Blore splutters. Quite possibly, but I'm also serious.
You didn't hear what I said? I mean you no harm.
Harm?
There is an edge to Holmes's voice that Watson has never heard before.
I know you. I remember you. Jonathan Blore. I know what you did to me, and I'd prefer to die rather than falling back into your hands.
He draws a breath. Watson and I are leaving. If anyone moves so much as an inch towards us, I will shoot myself. I mean it. I won't let you take me. Even Watson is unsure if he means what he is saying. The Sherlock Holmes that he has come to know is surely too full of life, too impressed by his own talents to take so drastic an action. Even Bloor is undecided. He stares in horror, poleaxed by the sudden reversal of fortune. 6 highly trained men, a perfectly laid trap. How can it have gone so wrong? Well? Holmes presses the gun harder against his cranium. Silence. It stretches out across the graves. But there can only be one conclusion. Let them go, Bloor commands, feeling the anger and the humiliation welling up inside him. Already he is wondering how he is going to explain all this to Mycroft the following day. Don't move. Thank you. Still holding the gun against his own head, his eyes twitching in every direction, Holmes walks towards the gates, followed by John, who cannot quite believe that this is happening. 2 of the men step aside to let him pass. None of them can believe this turn of events, and Holmes hasn't finished yet. His path takes him close to Jonathan Bloor, and as they pass, he suddenly whips round, grabs hold of Bloor, and presses the weapon against his neck.
What are you...
Bloor begins. I came here for information, Holmes snarls. Where were you going to take me? Where did I come from? Nothing from Bloor. Why do you say I have no name? This at least gets a response. You don't need one. You don't deserve one. You're nothing. Who is Moriarty? A malicious smile flits across Bloor's face. I'm almost tempted to tell you, but I'd prefer to leave you in ignorance. It will be so much more amusing when you do finally die. The 6 mercenaries are bulldogs on a leash, straining to be set free. For all his dismay, his loss of control, Jonathan Bloor has the upper hand. Holmes makes a decision. He snaps back the gun. Move, he says to John. Leaving Bloor behind him, the 2 men run for the gates. John is aware of the 6 thugs chasing after them. It's only the fog that protects them. Although there can't be more than a few meters between the fugitives and the would-be assassins, they can't see clearly enough to take a shot, particularly with automatic weapons which will spit a dozen bullets through the darkness. They cannot risk hitting Sherlock. And so the 2 of them reach the gates. They run out into Wilsdon Lane, and as luck would have it, a bus, not horse-drawn but powered by a proper diesel engine, is trundling towards them. John glances back and sees the pursuers too far behind. They are out of the cemetery, in a public space. There can be no gunfight here. They jump on the bus, drop a few coins into the driver's tray, sink into 2 seats. Holmes! John spits out the word as soon as he knows they are safe and he has regained his breath. You could have got us both killed! Not at all. Sitting in the front seat of the bus, Holmes is quickly returning to his old self. I saved your life, and mine, you didn't notice.
What?
The 6 men. Every one of their guns was pointed at you. I saw it the moment they appeared. You weren't the least bit important. They would have shot you without a blink of the eye. It was me they wanted. John isn't sure whether to be relieved or aggravated by this summary of what has just occurred. He would like to be considered relevant. At the same time, he has no desire to be shot. They sit in silence, regaining their breath. Irene Adler lied to you, John says, eventually. Yes, she did. John examines his friend, sitting next to him on the bus as it trundles down Wilsdon Lane. It occurs to him that following the events of the evening, Holmes has become even more of a mystery than he was before. What just happened? Who is Jonathan Bloor? And Moriarty? Meanwhile, Holmes stares out of the window, thinking of Irene Adler. He looks sad.